From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Kelpie by Manly Wade Wellman. No sooner had Cannon closed and latched the door than Lou was in his arms, and they were kissing with the hungry fierceness of lovers who doubt their own good fortune. Thus, for a delirious, heart-battering moment, then Lou pulled nervously away. "We're being watched," she whispered breathlessly. The big dark man laughed down at her worried blue eyes, her shining wealth of ale-brown hair, her face like an ivory heart, the apprehensive tautness of her slender figure. "That's guilty conscience, Lou," he teased. "You know I wouldn't have invited you to my apartment without giving my man the night off. And even if someone did see us, why be afraid? Don't we love each other?" She allowed him to bring her into the parlor and draw her down beside him on a divan, but she still mused apprehensively. "I could swear there were eyes upon us," she insisted, half apologetically. "Hostile eyes." "Maybe they're spirits," Cannon cried gaily, his own twinkling gaze sweeping around to view in turn the paintings on the walls, the hooded lamps, the bookshelves, the rich, comfortable furniture, the big box-draped aquarium in the darkest corner. Again he chuckled. "Spirits, that's a pun, you know, the lowest form of wit." From a tabouret at his elbow, he lifted a decanter of brandy and poured two drinks with a humorous flourish. Lou, forgetting her uneasiness of a moment before, lifted her glass. "To us," she toasted. But Cannon set his own drink down, untasted, and peered around a second time, this time without gaiety. "You've got me thinking it now," he muttered. "Thinking what?" "That something is watching and not liking what it sees." He glanced quickly over his shoulder, then continued, as if seeking to reassure them both. "Nothing in that corner, of course, except the aquarium." "What's the latest tenantry there?" Lou asked, glad to change the disquieting subject. "Some Scotch water plants, new laboratory project." Cannon was at ease the moment his hobby came into the conversation. "They arrived this afternoon in a sealed tin box. Dr. Mackenzie's letter says they were gathered from the pool kelp, wherever that is in his highland wilderness. I'm letting them soak and wash overnight. In the morning, I'll begin experimenting." Lou sipped more brandy, her eyes interested. "Pool kelp," she repeated. "It sounds seaweedy." "But these are freshwater growths, as I say. I never heard of the pool before," Cannon broke off. "Here, though, why talk botany when we can?" His lips abruptly smothered hers. His arms gathered her so close as to bruise her. But even as she yielded happily to his embrace, the telephone rang loudly in the front entry. Cannon released her with a muttered curse of impatience, rose and hurried out to answer. He closed the door behind him, and his voice, muffled and indistinct, sounded aggrieved as he spoke into the transmitter. Lou, finishing her brandy alone, picked up the drink Cannon had set down. As she lifted it to her lips, she glanced idly over the rim of the glass at the moist tangle in the aquarium. In the dim light, it seemed to fall into all manner of rich greens. Darkest emerald, beryl, malachite, olive, grass, lettuce, something moved too. Philip then swerved in the heart of the little submerged grove. Cannon was still talking. Lou rose, drink in hand, to stroll curiously toward the big glass box. As she did so, the moving trifle seemed to glide upward towards the surface. Coming closer yet, Lou paused to peer in the half-light. A fish? If so, a very green fish and a very small one, perhaps a tadpole. A bubble broke audibly on top of the water. Lou, genuinely interested, bent closer, just as something rose through the little ripples and hooked its tip on the rim of the aquarium. It was a tiny spinach-colored hand. Half a second later, another fringe of tiny fingers appeared, clutching the rim in turn. Lou, woodenly motionless, stared in her effort to rationalize. She could see the tiny digits. each tapering and flexible, each arm with a jet-colored claw. Through the glass, under and behind the fingers, she made out thumbs, deft, opposable thumbs, and smooth, wet palms of a dead, oystery gray. Her breath caught in mute, helpless astonishment. A blunt head rose slowly into view, behind and between the fists, something with flat brow, broad lump of nose, and wide mouth like a grotesque Mayan mask. And it was growing. Lou told herself, a little stupidly, that she must not have seen clearly at first. She had thought the creature a little green minnow, but it was as big as a squirrel. No, as big as a baby. Its bright eyes, white-ringed, fixed hers, projecting a wave of malignant challenge that staggered her like a blow. The full, lead-hued lips parted loosely, and the forked tip of her purple tongue quivered out for a moment. A snaky odor steamed up to Lou's nostrils, making her dizzy and weak. Wet, scabby green shoulders had heaved into view by now, and after them the twin mounds of her grotesquely feminine bosom. The thing was climbing out at her, and as it did so, it swelled and grew. The brandy glass fell from her hands and loudly exploded into splinters upon the floor. The sound of the breaking gave Lou back her voice, and she screamed tremulously, then managed to move back and away, half stumbling and half staggering. The monster, all damp and green and stinking, was writhing a leg into view. Lou noted that, and then everything went into a whirling white blur, and she began to collapse. Faintly, she heard the rush of Cannon's feet, felt the clutch of his strong arms, as through many thicknesses of fabric separated them from her. He almost shouted her name in panic. After a moment, her sight and mind cleared, and she looked up into his concerned face. With all her shaken strength, she clung to him. "That thing," she chattered, "that horrible female thing in the aquarium." Cannon managed a comforting tone. "But there's nothing, dearest, nothing at all. Those two brandies, you took mine too, you shameless glutton. Went to your head. Look at it," she pointed an unsteady finger. "Deep down there in the weeds." He looked. "Oh, that," he laughed. "I noticed it too. Just before you came, it's a little frog or toad. Must have been gathered with the weeds and shipped all the way from Scotland." Lou caressed her throbbing forehead with her slender white hand and mumbled something about seeing things. Already she believed that she had somehow dreamed of the green water monster, since it was a distinct effort to walk with Cannon to the aquarium and look in. Through the thick tangle of stems and fronds that made a dank stew in the water, she could make out a tiny something that wiggled and glided. It was only minnow-sized, after all, and seemed smooth and innocuous. Funny what notions too quick drinks will give you. She lowered a cup palm toward the surface, as if to scoop down and seize the little creature. But the chilly touch of the topmost weeds repelled her, and she drew back her arm. "You'd never catch it," Cannon told her. "It won't wait for you to grab. I had a try when I first saw it, and got a wet sleeve. And this," he held out his left hand. For the first time that evening, Lou saw the gold band that he wore on his third finger. "A ring," her lover explained. "It was lying on the bottom. Apparently, it came with the weeds, too." "You put it on your wedding finger," Lou wailed. "That was the only one it would fit," Cannon defended as she caught his hand and tugged with all her might at the ring. It did not budge. "Please," she begged, "get rid of it." "Why, Lou, what's the trouble? Are you being jealous because a present was given me by that mess of weeds, or maybe by the little lady frog?" The tiny swimmer in the tank splashed water, as if in punctuation of his joke, and Cannon, falling abruptly silent, suddenly began wrenching at the gold circlet, but not even his strength, twice that of Lou, could bring it over the joint. "Here, I don't like this," he announced, his voice steady, but a little tight. "I'm going to put soap on my finger. That will make the thing slip off." Lou made no reply, but her eyes encouraged him. Cannon kissed her pale forehead, strode across the room and into a little corridor beyond. After a moment, Lou could hear the spurt of a water jet in a bowl and the sound of industrious scrubbing with lather. In command of herself once again, but still a trifle faint and shaky, Lou leaned her hand lightly upon the thick, smooth edge of the aquarium glass. A fond little smile came to her lips as she pondered on Cannon's eagerness to please her whim. Not even in a silly little matter like this one did he cross her will or offer argument that might embarrass or hurt her. The shedding of that ring would be a symbol between them of understanding and faith. Her eyes dropped to the table that stood against the aquarium, with its litter of papers and notebooks. At the edge nearest Lou lay a thick volume bound in gray. A dictionary. What was the term she had puzzled over? Oh, yes. Still lounging with one hand on the glass, she flipped the book open with the others and turned the page to the K's. Kelp. Any one of various large brown seaweeds of the families. Her hazy memory had been right then about the word, but why should a body of fresh water be called pool kelp? Glancing back at the page, her eyes caught the next definition. It answered her question. Kelpie, Gael myth, a malicious water spirit or demon believed to haunt streams or marshes. Sometimes it falls in love with human beings, striving jealously against mortal rivals. The word swam before her vision, for the snake smell had risen sickeningly around her, and something was gripping the hand that rested on the rim of the tank. Lou's mouth opened, but as before, terror throttled her. Like a sleeper in the throes of nightmare, she struggled half-heartedly. She dared not look, yet some power forced her head around. The grip had shifted to her wrist. Long, claw-tipped fingers were clamped there, fingers as large as her own, scrofulous green and of a swampy chill. Lou's eyes slid in fascinated horror along the scale-rich corded arm to the moldy-looking body, stuck and festooned over with weed fronds that was rising from the water. Another fell hand stole swiftly out, fastened on Lou's shoulder, and jerked her close. The flat, grotesque face, grown to human size, was level with hers, its eyes triumphant within their dead white rings, its dark tongue quivering between gaping lips. Yet again Lou tried to find her voice. All she could achieve was a wordless moan, no louder than a sigh. "Did you call, sweetheart?" came Cannon's cheery response from his washing. "I'll be with you in a minute now. This thing is still hanging on like a poor relation." The reptilian jaw dropped suddenly, like the lid of a box turned upside down. Lou stared into the slate-gray cave that was the yawning mouth. Teeth, sharp teeth, gleamed there. Not one row, but many. Lou's hand lifted feebly in an effort at defense, then dropped wearily to her sides. The monster crinkled its humid features in something like a triumphant grin. Then its blunt head shot forward with incredible swiftness, nuzzling Lou at the juncture of neck and shoulder. For a moment, she felt exquisite pain as of many piercing needles. After that, she neither felt, heard, nor saw anything. The medical examiner was drawing a sheet over the still agony-distorted body of the dead girl. The police sergeant, scribbling his final notes, addressed Cannon with official sternness. "Sorry," he said, "but you haven't explained this business at all satisfactorily. You come down to headquarters with me." Cannon glanced wanly up from his senseless wrestling with the ring that would not quit his wedding finger. "I didn't do it," he reiterated dully. The medical examiner was also speaking, more to himself than anyone. "An autopsy might clear up some points. Those inflamed, suppurated wounds on the neck might have been made by a big water snake, or," he added with a canny glance at the sergeant, "by a poisoned weapon constructed to simulate such a creature's bite." Cannon's last vestige of control went. "I tell you," he snarled desperately, "that she and I were the only living things here tonight. The only living things." He broke off, becoming aware of movement in the aquarium. "Except, of course, that little frog in there." The creature among the weeds, a tiny sliver of agile greenness, cavorted for a moment on the surface of the water as if in exultation. Then, before any of the three watchers could get a fair look at it, dived deep into the heart of the floating mess. The Theater Upstairs by Manly Wade Wellman. "Look! A picture theater. Who'd expect one here?" Luther caught my arm and dragged me to a halt. We'd been out on a directionless walk through Lower Manhattan that evening. Flitting was Luther's word, cribbed, I think, from Robert W. Chambers. The old narrow street where we now pause had an old English name and was somewhere south and east of Chinatown. Its line of dingy shops had foreign words on their dim windows and lights and threadbare curtains up above where the proprietors lodged. And right before us, where Luther had stopped to gaze, was a narrow wooden door that bore a white card. "Cinema," it said, in bold, plain capitals, and in smaller letters below, Georgia Whittell. I was prepared to be embarrassed by that name. Everyone suspected, and a few claimed to know positively, that Georgia Whittell had committed suicide at the height of her Hollywood career because Luther had deserted her. But my companion did not flinch, only drew up that thick body of his. A smile wrinkled his handsome features, features that still meant box office to any picture, even though they were softening from too much food and drink and so forth. "Wonder which of George's things it is," Luther mused with a gaiety slightly forced. "Come on, I'll stand you a show." I didn't like it, but refusal would seem an accusation, so I let him draw me through the door. We had stairs to walk up, creaky old stairs. They were so narrow that we had to mount in single file, our shoulders brushing first one wall, then the other. I was mystified, for doesn't a New York ordinance provide that theaters cannot be on upper floors? There was no light on those stairs, as I remember, only a sort of grayness filtering from above. At any rate, we saw better when we came to the little foyer at the top. A shabby man stood there with lead-colored eyes and a square face and a great shock of coarse gray hair. "Admission a quarter," he mumbled in a soft, hoarse voice and accepted the $0.50 Luther produced. "Go on in." With one hand, he pocketed the coin and with the other drew back a dark, heavy curtain. We entered a long hall, groped our way to seats. We were the only patrons, so far as I could tell, and almost at once the screen lit up with the title, "The Horla," by Guy de Maupassant. "Creepy stuff, good," muttered Luther with relish, then added some other comment on the grisly classic. What with trying to hear him and read the cast of players at the same moment, I failed in both efforts. The shimmering words on the screen dissolved into a pictured landscape, smitten by rain, which the rain apparatus mimicked drearily. In the middle distance appeared a cottage, squat and ancient, with a droopy, soft-seeming roof like the cap of a toadstool. The camera viewpoint sailed down and upon it in what Luther called a dolly shot. We saw at close quarters the front porch. Two women sat on the top step, exchanging the inconsequential opening dialogue. Georgia Whittell, seated at center with her sad dark face turned front, was first recognizable. Her companion, to one side and in profile, offered to our view a flash of silver blonde hair and a handsome feline countenance. "It's Lillian Tashman," grunted Luther, and shut up his mouth with a snap. He might have said more about this uneasy vision of two dead actresses talking and moving, but he did not. A third figure was coming into view at the left, shedding a glistening waterproof and a soaked slouch hat. My first glimpse of his smooth black hair and close-set ears, seen from behind, struck a chord of memory in me. Then his face swiveled around into view and I spoke aloud. "This can't be," I protested. "Why? Rudolph Valentino died before anybody even dreamed of some..." But it was Valentino nevertheless, and he had been about to speak to the two women. However, just as I exclaimed in my unbelieving amazement, he paused and faced front. His gaze seemed to meet mine, and suddenly I realized how big he was on the screen. 8 or 10 feet high at the least. Those brilliant eyes withered me. His lips twitched over his dazzling teeth. The contemptuous rebuke expression of an actor to a noisy audience. So devastatingly real was that shadowy snub that I almost fell from my seat. I know that Luther swore and that I felt sweaty all over. When I recovered enough to assure myself that my imagination was too lively, Valentino had turned back to deliver his interrupted entrance line. The show went on. So far, there was nothing to remind me of de Maupassant's story as I had read it. But with Valentino's first speech and Georgia Whittell's answer, the familiar plot began. Of course, it was freely modified, like most film versions of the classics. For one thing, the victim of the invisible monster was not a man, but a woman, Georgia to be exact. And it seemed to me at the time that this change heightened the atmosphere of helpless horror. Valentino might have done something vigorous, either spiritual or physical, against de Maupassant's Horla. Georgia Whittell, with her sorrowfully lovely face and frail little body, seemed inescapably doomed. The remainder of the action on the porch was occupied by Georgia's description of the barely understood woes she was beginning to suffer at the Horla's hands. Miss Tashman, as her friend and Valentino as her lover, urged her to treat everything as a fancy, to tell herself that all would be well. She promised, but how vividly she acted the part of an unbeliever in her own assurance. Then the image of the porch, with those three shadows of dead players posed upon it in attitudes of life, faded away. The next scene was a French country bedroom. Curtain bed, perdue, and so on. Georgia Wattel entered it, unfastening her clothing. "Oh," exploded Luther somewhat lasciviously. But I did not stop to be disgusted with him. My mind was wrestling with the situation. How items so familiar in themselves, Lower New York, the motion picture business, the performers, the Maupassant story, could be so creepy in combination. Well, Georgia took off her dress. I saw as often before that she had a lovely bosom and shoulders for all her fragility. Over under things she drew an ample white robe, on the collar which fell her loose and dark hair. Kneeling for a moment at the prie-dieu, she murmured a half-audible prayer, then turned toward the bed. At that moment, there entered just where I cannot say the Horla. It was quite the finest and weirdest film device I have ever seen. No effect in the picture versions of Frankenstein or Dracula remotely approached it. Without line or opacity, less tangible than a shimmer of hot air, yet it gave the impression of living malevolence. I felt aware of its presence upon the screen without actually seeing it. But how could it have been suggested without being visible? I should like to discuss this point with someone else who saw the picture, but I've never yet found such a person. It was there anyway. Georgia registered sudden uneasy knowledge of it. Her body shuddered a trifle inside the robe, and she paused, as if in indecision, then moved towards the bed. A moment later, she moaned wildly and staggered a bit. The thing, whatever triumph of photodramatic trickery it was, enveloped her. She went all blurred and indistinct, as though seen through water. Doesn't de Maupassant himself use that figure of speech? Then the attacking entity seemed to pop out into a faint approach to human shape. I could see shadowy arms winding around the shrinking girl, a round, featureless head, bowed as if its maw sought her throat. She screamed loudly and began to struggle. Then Valentino and Miss Tashman burst into the room. With their appearance, the Horla released her and seemed to retire into its half-intangible condition. I, who had utterly forgotten that I saw only a film, sighed my inexpressible relief at the thing's momentary defeat, then whispered to Luther. "I don't like this," I said. "Let's get out, or I won't sleep tonight." "We stay right here," he mumbled back, his eyes bright and fascinated as they kept focused on the screen. Valentino was holding Georgia close, caressing her to quiet her hysterics and speaking reassuringly in his accented English. Lillian Tashman said something apparently meant for comedy relief, which was badly needed at this point, but neither Luther nor I laughed. Georgia suddenly cried out in fresh fear. "It's there in the corner," she wailed, turning toward the spot where the Horla must be lurking. Both her companions followed her gaze, apparently seeing nothing. For that matter, I saw nothing myself, though I well knew the thing was there. Valentino made another effort to calm her. "I'll put a bullet into darling," he offered with an air of falling in with her morbid humor. "In the corner, you say?" From his pocket, he drew a revolver. But Georgia, suddenly calming her shudder, snatched the weapon from his hand. "Don't," she begged. "How can a bullet harm something that has no life like ours?" "Here, don't point that gun at me," begged Miss Tashman, retreating in comic fright. Georgia moved forward in the picture, looming larger than her companions. "You can't kill spirits," she went on tonelessly and quite undramatically. "Bullets are for living enemies." She gazed out upon us. Right here is where the whole business stopped being real and became nightmare. Georgia moved again closer and closer until her head and shoulders, with a gun hand lifted beside them, filled the screen. She looked as big as a sphinx by then, but grim and merciless as no sphinx ever was, and her enormous accusing eyes weren't fixed upon me, but upon Luther. My inner self began arguing silently. "That's odd," it said plaintively. "A gaze from the screen seems to meet that of each member of the audience. How can she be looking past me at?" Georgia spoke between immense, hardened lips and a voice that rolled out to fill the whole theater. "Jan Luther!" And she swelled bigger, bigger beyond all reason, too big for the screen to contain. Suddenly, there were only the hand and the gun, turned toward us like a cannon aimed point blank. Luther was on his feet screaming. "You can't!" he challenged wildly. "You're only a shadow!" But the screen exploded in white light, that made the whole hall bright as day for just a hundredth part of a second. After that, I was trying to hold Luther erect. He sagged and slumped back into his seat in spite of all I could do. Blood purled gently down his face from a neat round hole in his forehead. I glanced wildly at the screen. The picture had shrunk back to ordinary dimensions now, showing again the bedroom, the three performers, and everything else exactly as it had been. Georgia was offering Valentino his pistol again. "Thanks, Rudy," she said. I suppose I must have run crazily out of there, for my next memory is of panting the story in broken sentences to a big blue-coated policeman. He frowned as I tried to tell him everything at once, then came back with me to the street with the foreign-labeled shops. When I couldn't find the door and its lettered card, he laughed, not very good-naturedly, and accused me of being drunk. When I tried to argue, he ordered me to move along or go to jail and sleep it off. I haven't seen Luther since, nor heard from him. There has been plenty in the papers about his disappearance, though several editors have put it down as a publicity stunt. 3 times recently, I have gone into the part of town where I lost him, and each time I have seen, at a little distance along the sidewalk or across the street, the white-haired, leaden-eyed man who admitted us to the theater. But, though I always try to hail him, he lost himself among the passerby before I reached him. At length, I have decided to stay away from there altogether. I wish I could stop thinking about the affair as well.